We turn now to a conversation with Mumia Abu-Jamal. The longtime political prisoner has just published his last work while he was on death row, called Message to the Movement. The award-winning journalist was moved to the general prison population earlier this year in Pennsylvania, where he is serving out a life sentence. It took years of activism and legal proceedings before Philadelphia's district attorney's office announced last year that it would drop its push for the death sentence and accept life in prison for Abu-Jamal. Mumia Abu-Jamal spent 30 years on death row for the 1981 murder of Philadelphia police officer Daniel Faulkner in a case that has drawn international attention. Abu-Jamal and his supporters maintain his innocence, and a long list of celebrities such as actor Danny Glover and Archbishop Desmond Tutu have called for his release or, at the very least, a new trial. Mumia Abu-Jamal is a former member of the Black Panther Party. Like other Panthers, he was subjected to government surveillance under COINTELPRO. Upon graduating from school, he pursued a career in broadcast radio journalism and worked at a number of radio stations. In 1994, he sued National Public Radio for canceling an agreement to air his radio commentaries based on complaints by the Fraternal Order of Police. Today, Mumia Abu-Jamal continues to make his voice heard through his regular radio commentaries at prisonradio.org, some of which can be heard on a semi-regular basis on this program, Uprising. Earlier this year, a group of high-profile activists such as Angela Davis and Cornel West held a day called Occupy the Justice Department, which, among other things, drew attention to Mumia Abu-Jamal. They are demanding a meeting with Attorney General Eric Holder over issues of police corruption and civil rights violations in the case of Abu-Jamal and many others. I want to talk to you about the Occupy Wall Street movement that you have expressed a lot of optimism about. You've called on people to occupy everything. What do you think is the ability of this movement to make real change, particularly changing our capitalist system?
Well, the credit must be given to Occupy for raising the question, or shall we say more accurately, stating the situation. By the simple slogan of we are the 99%, they targeted and focused on the wealthy and the super wealthy, who are in many ways the owners and the motors of American capitalist society. That by its very nature was anti-capitalist. It was not, one would say, Marxist, but it was certainly anti-capitalist in the sense of designating the immense power and the immense wealth held in the hands of the 1% and percentages of that 1%. I think that was a powerful and pregnant and really long-awaited beginning in the transformation of social consciousness. It certainly changed the minds of millions of people.
Now, I know this movement is very new, but I'm wondering what advice you can give, given that you are a member of the Black Panther Party, you're experienced with movements for social change, so you know well that movements that are effective can get attacked, and not just by police, but by politicians. They can get infiltrated to the point of implosion. What is your advice to the Occupy Wall Street movement against such pitfalls?
Well, just to tell them of my experience and the experience of many of my contemporaries, and to warn them against some of the mistakes, which were many, that we made. Many people of my generation look back with rose-colored glasses, in a sense, at the 60s, as if, you know, it was the time of ultimate perfection. Those of us who lived there obviously know that was not the case. You know, many, many mistakes were made, tactical, strategic. In many ways, a lot of people, especially in the white left, but also in the black left, melted away from the movement. Some because of the repression, others because they felt like they had won, that the social changes that they thought they were struggling for were solidified and made, and society was transformed. While that may have been the case on the surface, it was only the case.
This call is from the State Correctional Institution at Mahanoy and is subject to monitoring and recording.
It was only the case on the surface and not in the essence of society. Because as we see, if we had won what we thought we had won, we wouldn't have the society we have today. It wouldn't be as racially offensive. We wouldn't have this evil mass incarceration that we have. We certainly wouldn't have the public school system that we have. So I would just say, you know, in all honesty and in all modesty, that those of us who have been through movements and are a generation older than the occupiers have really much to learn from them, you know, because they're doing some pretty remarkable stuff. But we should also warn them against some of the mistakes we made, because, you know, that's the benefit of hindsight experience.
You brought up the issue of our racialized society, racial oppression and mass incarceration. The case of Trayvon Martin in 2012 has galvanized so many people, black, brown, and even white, even some conservatives. And I'm wondering why you think it took the killing of this teenage boy to draw attention to an issue that has dogged people of color for decades.
I think it was two things. The convergence of kind of the youth and the real beauty of this kid, and the convergence of social media and what that means. Because while people all across the country reacted, when you really saw the organizing, that is to say, people walking out of school, people going to mass protests, these were very young people. These were school-age kids. Trayvon's contemporaries, his colleagues, his cohort, that really pushed and took to the streets. It wasn't shall we say, established organizations. And I think because, you know, many kids his age looked at it and said, damn, that could be me, that could be my brother, you know, that could be my homie, you know. And in fact, it could have been. It could have been anybody. And it was, in many ways, anybody. And just the kind of blatant way that it was done and how the state reacted, which was as if nothing had happened, moved people to action and forced them into protest.
President Obama said that Trayvon Martin could have been his son. And I'm wondering then if you think that we are also at a time now where the broader issue of mass incarceration is reaching awareness. People like Michelle Alexander have brought this issue into the mainstream, particularly how it affects black men. And although this is an issue that progressives have been familiar with for a long time, do you think that there's a broader public awakening about the racism of the criminal justice system?
I think we're at the beginning of it. I don't think we've really reached the cusp of it. I think people like Michelle have certainly raised the issue in the same way that Occupy has raised the 99% issue. However, I don't know if Michelle has broken through to mass consciousness. She certainly has sold a great number of books and you know, spoken to a lot of people in her book tours across the country. You know, you don't see her on corporate mass media often. And so there's still a kind of mass incarceration ghetto, and it needs to break through. Part of the problem, I think, is, you know, people have, in black communities, in Latino communities, know it in their bones, know it in their experience, know it in the fact that, you know, many of their mothers and fathers and brothers and cousins and uncles and sisters and daughters are in these situations. But it's a beginning, but it has, I think, a significant way to go. I think it's a good beginning, but it still has a ways to go.
The Occupy the DOJ event commemorating your birthday and calling attention to your case earlier this year seemed to try to bring together, at least thematically, the Occupy Wall Street movement and cases like yours and the issue of mass incarceration and imprisonment. Do you think that it's important for these two issues to converge, for people to connect them together? Will that strengthen the movement?
I actually do, because I think that, you know, one of the strengths, believe it or not, of the Occupy movement is its ability to morph and its ability to not get into any one box. That is to say, they're able to be flexible and respond to the conditions that exist around them and to respond one way or another. That allows them to, in essence, stretch and reach and touch people in ways that movements of previous generations did not. I speak here of, you know, one of the biggest movements in the 60s and certainly the early 70s was the anti-war movement. And it was, I think, the epicenter of what could be called the radical white left. What happened? Well, when the Vietnam War was over, much of that movement melted into, vapor, in a sense. You know, there's a movie that came out a few years after that called The Big Chill, and I think it captured the big chill of first the repression that forced people to discard their allegiances to the movement. But also there were, you know, this was the Me Generation. People went from, you know, some great well-known radicals went from, you know, protesting at the Pentagon to working on Wall Street and building capital. So I think that Occupy has been more flexible than that movement because it's not just about one thing. It's about the 99% and all of the issues that involve the 99%. Like mass incarceration, like mass unemployment, like mass underemployment. And so they're able to at least affiliate with movements that the older left really did not affiliate with.
I want to ask you, Mumia, about the presidential election this November that has prompted a debate among progressives over President Obama, who has embraced his war presidency. He's increased deportation rates of undocumented prisoners. He's embraced Wall Street firms.
From the State Correctional Institution at Mahanoy and is subject to monitoring and recording.
And I'm wondering how you assess his presidency. Is he an unwitting pawn or an active participant?
Well, I look at the presidency as a kind of right wing of the left, you know, presidency. That is to say, many of the things that he's doing, not the things he's saying, but the things he's doing, well, they could have been done by a Hillary Clinton or certainly a Bill Clinton. They're very Clinton-esque, and they are unabashedly imperial. That is, they support the empire and not the rhetoric of freedom and all that kind of stuff. They're also often outward-looking as opposed to inward-looking. What I mean when I say that is this, that for many, many of the people who voted for Obama, they were coming from an inward-looking place. That is to say, African-Americans saw him as one of us, and therefore this is a great historic opportunity to create change in a nation that black people have been trying to create change in for, you know, the better part of five centuries. But it was also very young people of under 30 ages who were of the hip-hop generation and saw a black president as a very cool thing and a transformation from, let's say, the Bush era and the era of their parents. So those two forces certainly converge to make an Obama presidency possible. What's the third variable? I think it was overwhelmingly white women who, instead of being turned on by the John McCain and Sarah Palin candidacy, were turned off and looked at Obama and said, you know, this is a nice guy, he's a reasonable guy, he certainly, you know, has a beautiful family, and they responded to him warmly. And those elements converge to make his presidency possible. But in terms of what he's been involved in, you know, it's been in many ways the same old thing. He certainly propped up Wall Street. He certainly saved the economic system. He did formally declare the end of the Iraq War and the de-escalation of the Afghanistan War, but he's also escalated what I call the drone wars, drone attacks, you know, in the hundreds and possibly thousands in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Somalia, in Pakistan, and in other places around the world. So, you know, in many ways, I think he's far more martial than people realize, even though, in honesty, he said he would be, you know. But I think it's less of a change than most people wanted or most people hoped for, and it's more like the same old stuff.
I want to ask you about the media. You've been a journalist since before your incarceration. You've continued to regularly produce radio commentaries. How has the narrowness of the media landscape affected your ability to get your work heard widely? NPR doesn't air your commentaries anymore, for example, but now there's a greater reach directly to people through social media and the internet.
Well, I think that's due to the transformation of what media is. There is corporate media, and there's social media. And the two are not yet the same. In corporate media, I remember reading an insert in The Nation about 10 years ago. And it illustrated a map of...
You have 60 seconds remaining.
...of who controlled American media. And you could literally take 11 people, and they control, say, 90-95% of all American media. So that kind of concentration has made the corporate media the most distrusted in my lifetime. I look at this stuff on TV, and I cringe because it's, you know, it's nothing close to news. So I think social media is growing to take the place of what corporate media has failed to do, and that is inform and serve the people.
You have 30 seconds remaining.
Well, Mumia Abu-Jamal, I want to thank you so much for joining us today in these last few seconds. Anything that you'd like to get out to our listeners?
Well, thank you so much, Sonali. I saw you on C-SPAN. I think you do really incredible work, and I thank you so much for the kind invitation. I send my love to all that help and support us on the move. Long live John Africa.